Local News, Culture, and NPR.
From Radio Catskill Studios in Liberty, New York, this is the local edition. I'm Jason Dolp. Thank you so much for being here with me tonight. We do have a lot of news to get to, including some more information following that car chase that happened on Memorial Day in the wee hours of the morning, leaving New York City into the Hudson Valley. Also talk about a pool party that the city of Newburgh held in the rain this past Friday. Those stories and more from Times Union. I talked to Lana Bellamy coming up in the program. But first, we do have breaking news today, because this afternoon at a business on Main Street, Honesdale, we've received word that two people were arrested by Immigrations and Custom Enforcement, otherwise known as ICE. And that happened this afternoon. The River Reporter's Liam Mayo was on the scene, and Liam is actually still there on the scene. Liam, welcome back to the local edition.
Hi, Jason. Thank you for having me on.
What happened, and how did it go down?
Yeah, so around 11:10 earlier today, Honesdale community members noticed ICE agents in sort of dressed-down uniforms at the Wayne County Courthouse. A little while later, they went into the courthouse, and a little while later, they emerged and sort of got in their full tactical gear and went over to Elegante's, which is a pizza place on Main Street in Honesdale. One man had been arrested by ICE in a similar raid about 2 months ago in March. And this time, agents came in around 11:50. They were there for a couple of hours. Around 12:45, agents led two employees out of the business in handcuffs, one man and one woman. And they stayed another couple of hours after that. And later on, they brought some boxes out, like bankers' filing boxes and a computer desktop.
Wow. So that speaks to a larger ongoing investigation there, potentially. What's the response from the community to all of this?
Yeah, the community really came out in force for this raid. There were a couple of differences from the one that happened in March. There was a little bit more advance notice with the agents sort of stopping at the courthouse before they went over to the business. And between then and now, community members had kind of worked on organizing, worked on spreading information and awareness that this could happen again. And throughout the period that ICE agents were at Elegante's, there were, I'd say, maybe 20 to 30 community members who just sort of posted up at the entrances and the exits to the building with phone cameras, asking agents questions when they could, receiving very little response, taking photos, taking videos, kind of documenting what was happening there.
Wow. Did you talk to any of these folks? What did they have to say?
Yeah. There was a bit of a sense of sort of the horror that this could happen here. There was a sense that watching it happened was kind of important. One woman said, or told the River Reporter, we shouldn't have to watch, but we do, and kind of said that when things like this happen, they erode our faith in what we've been told as citizens is the rule of law, and the protections that we have been told that rule of law enforces to us. So there were a lot of people asking the agents sort of to see a warrant, to provide their badge numbers, something the agents generally did not do. So there were just people trying to do their best out there to enforce transparency to an agency and to an operation that sort of across the country is being conducted without very much transparency.
Yeah, and you cite Borough Mayor Derek Williams, Honesdale Borough Mayor Derek Williams, as a source in this article. What's the word from Mayor Williams and any other officials in Honesdale?
Yeah, Mayor Williams was there. He was watching for a good chunk of it. He has kind of been active in talking about this since the first raid that came in. And today he said that transparency was really important at all levels of government, sort of local, state, and federal, and that people's presence here today was just kind of enforcing that transparency.
And at this time, is there, and I should let the listener know, I did say that, you know, we're talking to you now that you're still there on the scene. Of course, this is, as we're talking, it's 3:33 in the afternoon. So this is a few hours before this interview's airs. But I'm wondering, is there any word from the restaurant Elegantes, any word from family or acquaintances of the people who were arrested?
No, we haven't heard any word. As of yet, nothing officially.
Okay, what will you be looking for next as you continue to report on this?
I think ideally any kind of response from the agencies involved. During the raid in March, the ICE did eventually release the name of the person they had taken in that raid. I believe it was over a month after they had done it, and they didn't end up releasing any kind of firm charges at that time either. Just said there was suspicion of one thing or another. So I don't necessarily expect to have any updates within the near future, but very much hope to.
Okay. Well, Liam Mayo's story is up now at riverreporter.com. And thank you so much for being on the scene and giving us this update.
Thank you for having me on.
And we actually do have a little more news from the River Reporter coming up at the end of the program. I have another story from Ruby Rayner and a special little announcement and a special little conversation with Ruby that you're not going to want to miss. And that's coming up at the end of the program. For now, it's time for our check-in with Times Union Hudson Valley. And for that, earlier today, I spoke with Lana Bellamy of the Times Union. Lana, welcome back to the local edition.
Thanks for having me.
Earlier in the week, I related to the listener here the story about this car chase from allegedly the driver is underage, a chase that started in New York City and ended in Westchester County. And I just wanted to get some more details on that from you.
Sure, yes. We don't know much more about the chase incident other than what we've reported. And thankfully, the 16 people, including the driver, who were all sent to the hospital, have been released. So that's good. But there is the interesting part of it that I think a lot of people wonder about, which is, you know, when do police departments decide that they're going to pursue a vehicle, and how far do they let it get, you know, what's under their control there?
Yeah, and I thought that was interesting information that was there at the end of the article, kind of raising some of those questions. So, and some of this is what the Times Union had already been looking into, correct?
Yes, actually. We had two reporters, Emily Munson, an investigative reporter, and Chris Diffenstill, who was one of our past fellows, did a big review of more than 35 vehicle pursuit policies that are used by New York law enforcement agencies to sort of see, you know, how they make decisions and what the law allows. And they found out that New York laws actually give officers broad discretion to chase a fleeing vehicle. So a lot of it is left up to the independent agencies. And state police is one of those agencies that has a discretionary policy.
What's significant about that?
Well, it allows them to try to use their experience to gauge the situation, to weigh a few factors before they decide if they're going to chase a vehicle or not. And some of that is dependent on the weather and the road conditions. And it could be the time of day, too, if it's a, you know, typical rush hour or a time of heavy traffic. You know, is the risk to the public too great to start a pursuit? And I'm sure some of that also involves what the suspect is believed to have been accused of.
Right. So it's kind of like balancing these different factors. And you're talking about the risk to the public because, like, you know, you're chasing somebody in a car, you know, in this particular story that we're talking about, it happened at basically 2 a.m. on Monday. NYPD reported erratic driving in the Bronx. And then the vehicle they were kind of tracking, you know, headed upstate, headed up I-95, and where, you know, troopers encountered the vehicle when he got close to Rye. But those 16 injuries you mentioned, one of them was the driver. Four of them was other people that were in the driver's car. And the other 11 were people that were in multiple other vehicles. There was, they said, a chain reaction, according to the state police, a chain reaction crash. But you're talking about the broad discretion they have in deciding whether or not to take engage in a chase, these different factors that they have to balance. I mean, the reporter on the story kind of juxtaposed that with some national information that kind of speaks to what the risks are to the public.
Yes, and actually our reporter who wrote this story, Nora Mishnick, she was at our Fellow Hearst paper at the San Francisco Chronicle, which is the paper that she linked to that did a nationwide investigation about police pursuits. And they're also, you know, nationally not governed by any binding, you know, standards. And their investigation found that two people a day on average are killed by fleeing drivers. And most of those are bystanders and passengers, you know, people who are uninvolved in the pursuit.
That's researching on average two people a day, not just injured, but lose their lives.
Correct. Yes. Wow. And she did report too that state police had said that the chase that happened in Rye fell within the agent's pursuit, you know, within the purview of the agency's pursuit policies based on a preliminary review. I don't want to speculate too much, but you did bring up that it was at 2 o'clock in the morning. So you do have to wonder how much traffic was really on the roads. But given that there were 16 people in four cars, and it seems like there was at least a little bit, you know, there. So.
Yeah, because even at 2 a.m., not these aren't just busy roads at any time, but it was a holiday weekend as well. It was the end of holiday weekend, so there's yeah. That factor as well. Other things I'll just bring up the list. Again, I don't want to speculate, and we don't have reporting on this, but I do want to remind the listener that we've talked with the Times Union before about a spike of pedestrian injuries, vehicles striking pedestrians over the last couple of years, you know, in New York State, particularly in the Hudson Valley. At the same time, it seems like there are just more vehicular crimes going on. The past few years coming out of the pandemic, you know, more road rage incidents, more stolen cars, all sorts of things happening with vehicles that are not entirely safe for the general public. And I just thought this was interesting information to take into account with all of that.
Yes, it is. And you know what? That also brings me to another interesting aspect of the Rye crash is that Nora learned through state police that the driver who was accused of fleeing, he was in a 2002 Lexus that had Connecticut license plates but were registered to another car, which is, you know, a tactic known among law enforcement as plate swapping, and it's used to help avoid police detection. And make it harder to track down a vehicle that's used in a crime. So that's another interesting aspect to that story as well, if you're talking about different vehicle crimes.
I'm remembering that from the story now, and I'm curious, I don't know if you know this offhand, but I'm wondering, is that something that law enforcement knew as they were in pursuit, as they were like trying to look up the plates, or is that something that they figured out afterwards? Because that could be another factor in their decision to go after this driver.
I don't know that, but that's a great question,
yeah.
Because whenever the NYPD issued a BOLO, a Be on the Lookout alert, it sounds like they had mentioned that the car was driving erratically, the person. Yeah. So I don't know if maybe they found that out during the pursuit or already knew that.
So yeah, moving on to another story here, and this is about, you know, development in the Hudson Valley and Catskills. And this is about the town of Catskill is started working on a $10 million grant. Working, meaning doing work that they received a $10 million grant for. Well, what was this grant and what are they doing with it?
Yes, so the village of Catskill, they finally, after two previous failed attempts at getting that coveted $10 million top downtown revitalization initiative grant, they finally got it last year. And this grant is supposed to help these municipalities do this sort of last mile of funding, so to speak, for several projects that will really help result in a transformation to their downtowns. But it involves so much work. So even though they finally crossed, you know, that threshold of getting the grant, the real work for selecting which projects will be funded has only just begun.
Wow. Well, congrats to them. I saw like some of the comments from the people that worked on the grant and like how much they wanted this in the town and the things that they were saying about like how much this meant to them. And it was really like, you feel really good that they were actually able to do this.
I know. I mean, gosh, real tears were shed over this. To quote, I think it was the mayor who said that. So it is a happy story. And part of their application process is getting together a group of projects that they're sort of informally in a way pitching, like these are certain things that we could use the money for. And a lot of that was housing and businesses and recreation that's tied to a specific area. So the grants also aren't supposed to fund a transformation for the whole geographic area of the community. You're supposed to just focus in on a particular area. So what Catskill did this time around, which was different from their other applications, is they focused on the area around the Catskill Creek.
Oh.
So all of the projects they've identified for potential funding are connected to that in some way. And now what they have to do is get a committee together, and over the next 9 months, they're going to go back through a list of potential projects that they'll vote on, and then formally ask the state to use that $10 million to fund.
Yeah, and I'm wondering, like, Catskill Creek, it's something there in the village, but, I mean, it sounds like that's like a neighborhood, has different components to it.
Yes, and, you know, the creek is, it sort of bisects the village. It's really an interesting asset that they have. So I'm anxious to see how they'll use these projects to make that a more sort of bustling part of their village.
All right, that's great. And now you also have at Times Union, Hudson Valley, a really interesting profile on Tom Sitt. This is the owner of Eng's Chinese Restaurant in Kingston, and he's been running that for half a century. Is that right?
Yes, nearly 50 years. It was Kingston's first Chinese restaurant, potentially the first in Ulster County. We're not really sure. But yeah, Maria Silva, one of our reporters, she sat down with Tom Sitt because his restaurant, Ing's, even though it's been around for a long time, got a sort of renewed amount of attention tied to a couple different things. The launch of the restaurant's Instagram page, its cameo in Apple TV's Severance this past season. It was the restaurant Zufu that you may have seen Adam Scott sitting in at one point.
Wow.
And also the reopening of their dining room, which had been closed for 5 years because of the pandemic.
Oh, wow. They just reopened their dining room?
Yes. Kingstonians are very happy that they can finally go back in there to eat.
So I'm sure you want people to actually read the profile and learn the story for themselves, but can you tell us a little bit about Tom Sitt and his story?
Oh, yes, definitely, because there's no way that I could really cover everything from his past anyway, just in an interview. But she goes all the way back to she talks to Tom, who goes all the way back to his childhood, where he was born in mainland China. And by the time he was a teenager, he was living through China's Great Famine in the 50s and 60s and the launch of the Great Proletarian Cultural Revolution. So he decided that he wanted to flee the oppressive government, and he joined a group that became known as the Freedom Swimmers, thousands of young men and women, and they fled to Hong Kong. But while he was in Hong Kong and he got work in a plastics factory, I mean, the Freedom Swimmers were considered traitors, so he felt like his time was limited there before he might be found by the Chinese government. So he needed to continue his journey west, and so he fled to the U.S. as a political refugee, and through a couple of turn of events, found his way to Kingston, where he began working for the Kingston Tea Garden, which was owned by the same people who opened Ng's restaurant, or Ng's Chinese restaurant. And so that's how he became affiliated with the eateries. He began working there as a cook, and then he became great friends with the owners, who then, after only 2.5 years of Sit being a cook, gave the restaurant to him when they retired.
Wow. All right. So even just with just spending that long on here is brief amount of time, that this is already a pretty amazing story.
Oh, definitely. It's definitely worth your time. It's a long one, but it's a good one.
Wow, that's great. Well, Lana, before we go, I do want to ask you about a story that you wrote, and I'll just remind listeners, you know, we just had a holiday weekend, and it wound up being pretty nice by the end of the holiday weekend, you know, by like Monday. But when it started, like on Friday and Saturday, it was still pretty cold and wet. Nonetheless, sounds like Newberg decided to have a pool party on Friday.
They did, in the rain. They held a big press conference on Friday to celebrate the long-awaited return of the city's only public pool. It's been in the works for a while, and I wrote a story, gosh, it was 3 years ago, when Mayor Torrance Harvey declared that he was willing to go to war over this pool after it had been delayed again by what contractors said were, you know, delays with shipping and material shortages. I mean, it looks like they stuck to their plan ever since then and opened it on time on Memorial Day weekend on Friday, even though it was pouring the rain. They were all super excited.
It's probably the happiest people had ever gathered at a pool in the rain at the start of the summer season, the unofficial start of summer in upstate New York. And well, congrats to Newberg on their giant $15 million pool. Well, and Lana, congrats to you for everything that you do at the Times Union. These stories we all talked about now are at timesunion.com. We've been talking to Lana Bellamy, Times Union, Hudson Valley. Thank you so much, Lana.
Thank you.
You're listening to The Local Edition, winner of Excellence in Broadcasting Awards from the New York State Broadcasters Association. Radio Catskill. Listen local.
It is The Local Edition. I'm Jason Dole. And I want to thank you so much for being here with me tonight. We do have one more news story to get to. And for that, I turn to Ruby Rayner of The River Reporter. We had some technical problems last night. We're not able to air this piece. Ruby has an update on the fate of an ag program in Wayne County.
This Agriculture Innovation Center, they use the acronym AIC, is really one of the big goals of the Wayne County Commissioners. COVID-19 pandemic exposed a lot of weaknesses in Wayne County's food and farm systems as kind of a trickle down of that being exposed throughout the country during that time. And so the county was like, we got to agriculturally take a look at what's going on and make sure that we are creating this very sustained future. And that's when these ideas and this kind of first draft concept map created in June of 2020 for the Agriculture Innovation Center came to be. And they've done quite a bit of work. You know, they've conducted a study to see, you know, a feasibility study. They've made pretty concrete plans. The first draft concept shows the center being divided into kind of these various sections, including, you know, agricultural resources, but also food for security section, food for health, innovation in a green zone. And they, you know, talked a lot about the future of the AIC, the Agricultural Innovation Center, having this central location called the hub. And, you know, future plans also included, you know, USDA livestock processing sections, along with like having an expansion of mixed-use retail so that people could come and also, you know, partake in a lot of the agricultural innovation that would go on there, as well as restaurants and even apartments. So this kind of plan is pretty extensive and thought out. And the feasibility study concluded that required for just the original concepting, so those different centers of that I first mentioned would be approximately $10 million. And so although the center has a very strong support from both the community as well as county leadership, especially the Wayne commissioners, it's a pretty sizable amount of money that's needed, and finding funding has been difficult, which, you know, shouldn't be a shock. It often is with kind of big undertakings like this. And during recent county commissioner meeting, Commissioner James Shook explained that Wayne County is just restricted in its access to federal fundings for something like the AIC because of the fact that many of the county's farms are in this smaller kind of acreage category compared to those in other parts of Pennsylvania. And so they're kind of cut out of qualifying for some of these funding streams. That larger acreage farms are able to qualify for that produce more. And so he said they're really trying to find the money. And right now they're kind of in order to, you know, try to make meet somewhere in the middle because of the what he called an extraordinary cost, is that they're probably going to come up with something a little bit more slimmed down to the original AIC suggestion. And so Jocelyn Kramer, you know, she brought up, Commissioner Jocelyn Kramer brought up this compromise design. And so that's really kind of where the project sits now, is that they're going to look at what's most necessary and what's most needed out of all of the different ideas that were originally going to sit in the AIC Agricultural Center, and then kind of try to pare down that to something that might be more doable.
And that's the latest local news from the River Reporter. All these stories that we've been talking about right now are up at riverreporter.com. And we've been talking to Ruby Rayner of the River Reporter. But before we go, Ruby, you have one more item to report to folks, more of a personal nature.
Yes, this will be my last local edition. As I'm leaving the River Reporter, and I'm no longer going to be reporting in the area. So it's very bittersweet for me, as I love talking to you, Jason, weekly.
Well, it's bittersweet for me too. I enjoy getting these updates from you, and while I'm sad to lose you, I'm excited for what you are going to be moving on to and doing next. But I mean, before I ask you about that, I do want to say thank you so much for everything that you have done for us and the community with the River Reporter in covering all of this news this time that you've been here with us. So what's next for you? What are you moving on to?
Well, I'm staying in journalism because I love it so much, and I love reporting on things. And so I'm going to be working as the politics reporter for the Chattanooga Times Free Press in Tennessee. So I'll be covering Tennessee politics from a local angle, from a Chattanooga angle. So that's what I'll be doing. And I'm looking forward to taking all of what I've learned here covering Sullivan County. And I'll miss it a lot.
From the Catskills down to the Smoky Mountains, it's Ruby Rayner. I wish you all the best, and I thank you again so much for all you've done with us.
Thank you.
Big thanks once again to Ruby Rayner, the River Reporter, and big thanks to you for sticking with us through the local edition tonight. Thank you so much for listening. I'm Jason Dole. Tim Bruno's here with you tomorrow morning at 10 for Radio Chatskill. We got local news every morning and every afternoon, every weekday, right here on Radio Catskill. And it's all thanks to listeners like you that support this station. So thank you so much for that. Check out our website, wjffradio.org, and stay with us now. We've got more news before we get to the music tonight at 7 on Retro Cocktail Hour. First, it's The Daily. This is Radio Catskill, local news, culture, and NPR.